thanks to Sunfalls, Dr. Strangenub, and Palo for appearing on A Different Nature, which you were just listening to. I'm Becky, and I'm saying farewell to you. Stay tuned for an amazing episode of Talking Earth. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir in Portland. Portland bands Foxy Lemon, Camp Crush, and The Get Ahead will play bluesy rock, new wave pop, and country-fied soul to benefit Portland Homeless Family Solutions, which helps families with children find housing. Again, that's the holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir, 830 East Burnside Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
Hello, you're listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard. You're listening to KBO Portland, 90.7 FM. And I have the good fortune to be here in the studio with Megan Levad, who has just put out a new book. She is the author of Why We Live in the Dark Ages. That's her first book that I just had the good fortune to read through. And she just came out with What Have I to Say to You? Actually, at the time of this recording, it's not actually out yet, which is why I was very disappointed when I went to Powell's recently. her first book, Why We Live in the Dark Ages, was the first selection in Tavern Books' Rolstad Contemporary Poetry Series. A recent MacDowell Fellow, her poems have appeared in Tin House, Granta Online, Fence, and the Everman's Library Anthology Killer Verse, among other publications. She also writes lyrics and libretti. Her first opera, Kept, with composer Kristen Koester, premiered in May 2017. And she's going to read a couple pieces out of her new book, What Have I to Say to You? Right now.
Thanks, Patrick. I have no one to talk to. I am my own Texas. I am a stadium filled with screaming fans. I have no one to talk to. I am Amelia Earhart, piloting the Kitty Hawk with the Lindbergh baby strapped to my chest. I am first in everything. I am a career violinist. The bruise on my neck, I did it to myself. Reader, the news from this country, weather, stock prices, closely follows that of your own. Every front and surge is a message. Hollywood turns to me in the grocery line, says she could hold two lies in her mouth at once, before the crown of her head unfolds like a mourning dove and flies away. I like to wear your clothes. And not just because I like that mask. I want to ask how you feel with me in your closet, your bathtub, your love, your country, your treehouse, your trunk. No, I want you to ask me. Online dating turns to me from the climbing wall, says, I'm all laid back like a hippie on a yoga mat. She's up there pretty high, the footholds, pumpkin, ham bone, black walnut, sequins, even close up, are motes from down here. And I am the someone somewhere holding the rope. Veganism turns to me at the cafe, says, this green tea latte tastes like truth. But I am caught up in a scheme, and nothing has tasted like truth since the last time I shot clays with you. Reader, I'm sorry I can't be more helpful. I'm only an assistant.
Perhaps we want to take a break at that one. So this book is very different in terms of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Just having been able to breeze through it a little bit, your earlier book was a selection of prose poems about science or the misunderstanding of science.
Yeah.
All in one voice. I mean, I would argue it's a very different voice, although mm-hmm. that's also one person's voice, I think, in your new book.
Yeah, I think it feels pretty unified,
it's
too.
It's a different story.
Yes,
too.
Yeah.
I only had a, well, maybe I'll ask it later when we're reading from the old book. I was just taken aback by how different you're able to change your work. And I've known some poets able to do this. I mean, it's a poet I had on a while ago who submitted a work and it was all standard poetry. And then by the time he was finished with it and it actually got published, it's a little bit like yours in terms of the structure, italics. And but it was also like... it was cut up too, and I'm just impressed by how much the actual poetry you're putting out is changed.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, I tend to be sort of a project poet, which I think sometimes that is considered a little bit less poetic. For lack of a better word, I think we still have a sort of desire for the poet to be almost kind of a romantic, you know, in the sense of Wordsworth, Keats, like that we are moved to capture a feeling, right, in words. And for me, it's actually much more of an intellectual exercise than, I mean, the emotion is certainly there, but I'm really interested in using language to explore a thought. Or a thought process.
And also, it seems like there's a unity there that wouldn't necessarily be there if you were just spontaneously.
Yeah, that's probably true, too.
You know, and that's a very good thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just...
Thank you.
I also struck by the different use of space in the actual works, too.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, for me, I have to be able to sort of hear the tone and the rhythm of a project before I really kind of can get started on it. And I also have to be able to see it on the page. And so I knew with the new book that I wanted a lot of white space. I wanted a lot of air in the poems.
And I also read that you're working on a novel. You have a novel in progress. It's all poems.
Yeah. Novel and poems. Yeah.
Okay. So, completely different structure.
Yeah. 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 And written in sort of a close third person. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Trying to think how I should. I just assume everything's in third person half the time. But yeah,
right. Yeah,
yeah. You're writing in first person the first two books. Is that correct or am I wrong?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to read a little bit more?
Sure. Happy to. My love is a Christmas tree farm set aflame by two kids with wild minds, and my love is the flask of bourbon, the apple, and the matchbook. And my love is the wet spot on the scarf where breath melts. My love is a fungus, hidden a few inches underground or in the air's plain sight, only fruiting for a few hours after a rain. Given a whole day to meditate on your beauty, I come up with a tacky fishing lure of bobs and dangles, cherry pie, beaver skin, the smell of cold wool, some foxing, held together on a bright blonde line. Your line was always, "That's right," since I gave it to you, the right, that is, to tell me what is. The beauty of your beauty is that you don't see it. The tight flesh that naps your nose, the color of blood that shies out from under your cheeks, the ends of your fingers whorled. Okay, I'm beginning to agree with them. Your face fits your face, and it fits your open palms. Your face fits my open palms, too. Prosperity Christianity turns to me at the veterinarian's office, says she got together with her high school boyfriend. The cat spits pink medicine all over the vet's assistant. Her kids are having a real hard time with it. I still love you so much, if I met you again, I'd have to kill you for your pelt. The psychos aren't wrong. They can't help it. They're appendices, tailbones, vestigial parts of a much longer history. A history as long as ours.
God. That could refer to a lot of things, couldn't it? I mean, that could be the North American history of a relationship, which it seems like that's the... Some of it seems like it's a story of a relationship. I also like the prosperity Christian. I never...
Yeah.
Or prosperity Christianity. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, that's... very, very witty.
Thank you.
Your other book was very witty as well, too.
I
was trying to. So I take it. There's a bunch of different. It's a bunch of poems in one voice.
Mm-hmm.
But different situations. It's not just like about a relationship or various relationships.
That's right. Yeah.
Meeting people at the supermarket and what's going on in their lives,
even though
they happen to be a prosperity Christian or veganism.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it starts out, I think the first, so there are three types of poems in this book, which is really, it really runs together as one long poem. Some of them are sort of aphoristic. Some of them are apostrophe, so those are the ones that sound like they're addressed to this absent lover. And then some of them are these little scenes. And the first one is your mother. So it starts with much more intimate relationships and then sort of spirals out to abstractions like love and loss by the end of the book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily lead into my next question, but what poets and writers have influenced your work and what you've been, you know, the stuff you're even writing before just influenced you as a young age, and also like what's influenced you with these two books and the forthcoming novel?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think, you know, my earliest influences were probably songs. So it's interesting because I write with composers, a lot of my more formal work is saved for being set to music. So in a sort of very, very classical way, I have this sense that, you know, that's what those rhyming and metered forms are for, is to be songs. So the work that's for the page still has some of that element to it, because I'm very interested in sound, you know, like all poets, right? We like the sounds of the words. And so there's lots of kind of sneaky rhyme. But yeah, so sound is pretty key to me. But as far as like, you know, contemporary poets or even older. When I got to college, then I discovered William Carlos Williams and Gertrude Stein, and I think that they're both still hugely influential in my work. I think the first book, Why We Live in the Dark Ages, definitely has a Steinian sense of trying to capture both the movement of a thought in language and also the way we actually speak. And how we can understand each other even when the syntax is
off.
Totally off. Yeah. Yeah.
Although I do have to say that there's a pattern to the syntax of that speaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. Well, I mean, the thing is that I was just sort of fascinated with the first book, with Why We Live in the Dark Ages. That actually started because I was hanging out with a composer friend who I collaborate with often, Tucker Fuller. He's a composer in New Orleans. And he was telling me about some Radiolab episode that he had heard. And as he was telling me, I was so interested in the way that he was using language, the way he was describing, I think it was nanobots, actually.
There is a little piece about nanobots in there.
There is, yeah. And that was the first one. I think that was the first one that was written. So as he was talking, I just opened up my laptop and I just started taking dictation, typing exactly what he was saying, including all the ums and the little elliptical moments. And I thought that was so interesting to sort of see on the page what he had actually said, but then contrast that with how well I could understand what he was explaining. So I asked him to do a few more and to tell me about different things. And then I sort of put them aside. I thought it was just kind of a funny little like Friday night project. But I kept thinking about them, and so went back to them later and started writing more imagining voices and imagining how we actually talk about, how we talk about science and try to explain things to one another, how we talk about history. Some people have compared the Why We Live in the Dark Ages to drunk history, but it's about science. So, and I guess my...
Some of it is accurate, but I wouldn't take all of it as
exactly,
accurate, actually. It's
exactly.
A little, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little tricky in that way, right? Because that is our experience, is that when we share information with each other, some of it can be totally accurate and some of it is
false.
False, yes.
Off.
Yeah.
And so it's very useful. I didn't do this, but it would probably be useful to have your laptop or iPhone or whatever, tablet, whatever internet device to check the accuracy of some of the statements and see whether you should apply them to your life or not. I don't think the nanobots are coming anytime soon, unfortunately.
They're working on it.
That's what they... I remember Greg Bear's... Greg Bear and Neal Stephenson wrote science fiction novels in the late 80s, early 90s, and with nanoscience, and that's not here yet. And there's other stuff that's shown up since then.
Although, that's true.
I mean, yeah, technically we do have those things from Star Trek in our hands.
Right? Our pocket computers?
Yeah. That's technically what we have, you know? Yeah. You know, they still can't, like, just fix you using the...
Right. Not yet.
Medically. But anyway, yeah, that's... I found that very interesting. I found the title poem very interesting in that it diagnoses one of the issues is that people do not understand the language of science, and therefore things get misapplied. I mean, for instance, people doubt the efficacy of or the relative danger of not giving vaccines to their children.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Because of and it's that is an issue, and it's in some ways we're always living in the dark ages.
You'd
like to hope that the future is lighter, but you don't always know that.
Yeah. Well, and because most of us are in the dark when it comes to how decisions, discoveries are made. We are so highly specialized now in our fields, and then particularly with science, like most of us really don't understand very well how things... I mean, we might understand the basics of how things work, but a lot of that information, I mean, you have to become an expert to really understand.
I used to get copies of Scientific American and I didn't understand half of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe even less than that. And some of it I don't think was actually science either, but that's my own.
Yeah. Well, but isn't it exciting though? So something that I find very hopeful and that I sort of love is that we can actually be okay with not fully understanding and even interested and intrigued, rather than being fearful.
Oh, I was definitely not fearful reading it.
Yeah,
sometimes it just... I hate to say, sometimes I would get bored if I didn't understand, or I'm just like, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to put the energy towards this.
We kind of check out.
And then sometimes the ones I was reading fully were the ones that I knew were the most ridiculous. Like when scientists talk about the multiverse, it's like, really, they're just playing with math. They don't have any, there's no proof there. So,
right.
But I read all those articles.
Yeah. So, yeah, because it's fun to think about.
It's fun to think about. Yeah. That is kind of a... Yeah. And the other thing I was thinking about, though, is that I'm not sure if I would argue that scientists are... I think there is like a problem in terms of science, the language of science being not understood by lay people, but there's also a problem that science is also like governed by the amount of money sent to like its funding.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is it's a very interesting book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Where do we want to go?
Would you like me to read a little bit from it?
Sure.
I'd love to. Thanks. Why don't I read? I'll read the title poem, which you were just talking about. Why We Live in the Dark Ages. Oh, the Dark Ages. Let me tell you about the Dark Ages. Okay. Oh. I was reading this lecture by Jacques Barzun, 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 who is a great culture historian, art historian. Anyway, the lecture was called The Use and Abuse of Art. And there's this section in this lecture where he talks about the Dark Ages and how it relates to our own time, a very popular subject. And he made a very interesting point that the reason why, a very interesting point that in the Dark Ages, the people of this time period were smart people, essentially. They had art, they had, interesting conversation. I don't know, they were consumers, they were functioning people. But the reason why we refer to it as the Dark Ages is basically because the populace of, we view them as being sort of dumb. And from our standpoint, because they weren't literate in the Latin, which was the language everything was being written in for, like, the intellectuals, and all this intellectual thought was going on and was controlled largely by the church. And he makes a comparison to our own time, where our populace is, you know, we may be literate and producing art and doing all these sorts of things, but the power within our society is in science. And that, most of us sort of everyday people don't really understand science very well. And like Latin to the church, sort of like abstract or any sort of scientific thought isn't common language among our society at all. And all the power is held with scientists or this very select group of people in the scientific community.
So yes, that's a very interesting argument. I don't know how much I agree with it, but I respect that.
Yeah.
I just feel like in some ways, now I'm going off on a tangent, but yeah. Nikola Tesla wanted to give electricity to the world, which might have been a very dangerous thing for him to do. Mm. But he was being funded by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan cut him off when he realized that he wanted to send electricity from his tower in Long Island, New York, to anywhere in the world for free.
Oh.
So you don't get to do... The funding is always there, and whoever controls the funding. But in a way, scientists do have a lot of power over the world, because what they create can have effects that are farther reaching than anyone can realize.
Yeah, I think that's so.
It's kind of a complex thing. But it's... That piece totally fits in with everything else in the book, and it makes, it's very much the theme. And
yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately, if the book is making an argument, it's that we, so much of the information that we exchange isn't really about the information, it's about the exchange. It's a way to connect with one another. Now, that said, I wrote this book about 5 years total, picking it up, putting it down, kind of figuring it out. And that it came out in 2015. So we weren't really talking about misinformation in quite the same way that we are now.
Yes, that is true. Yes, we had some leaders who were a little more scientifically literate.
Yes. And I think that we hadn't really maybe realized like exactly how bad we are at detecting whether information is accurate or not.
No, it definitely can be. That is also a weakness of our particular electorate, at least, if not large parts of the world as well. But I wanted to get back to something else, which is that you write formal pieces for Libretti. for opera. And then you also came out with this prose poem, Book of Prose Poems, which is very different structure. And it's almost like, do you feel that having different forms like enables you to like achieve more in each form?
It
balances out your work structure in life in a, or poetry.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I think most of it too just comes from the fact that, you know, when I'm writing a song, when I first started, the very first song lyrics that I wrote were actually with my friend Tucker, the composer I mentioned, when I was talking about the sort of inspiration for Dark Ages. And I literally just thought of songs that have a structure I like and then rewrote the lyrics to them in my head. The great thing about this with Tucker is that he is not well-versed in pop music or country music or, you know, like anything other than classical pretty much, and Tin Pan Alley and like jazz. So he didn't know what I was riffing off of. He wouldn't recognize that the structure of a certain song was based on The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, for example.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And so then he said it in the way that he heard it in his head. So that was kind of how I started with the structure of songs. And then I went on to start using like villanelles, sonnets, pantoums, all of these forms that, you know, can be sung, but also sort of fit the way I wanted the thought to move or the emotion to move. So, for example, with a villanelle, you know, if you're, it's about kind of worrying over something because it has those repeating first and third lines, and it's in these tercets, and tercets move really rapidly, right? Because you're always starting or ending something. So that's a great way to capture, like I said, sort of a ruminating feeling, where a thought kind of transforms.
And it transforms from the beginning to the end and kind of encapsulate, you express all of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Whereas a pantoum is a little bit more, I think it creates more of an otherworldly effect because it has these repeating second and fourth lines, and it's written in quatrains, four line stanzas. And because of that repetition, there is a way in which it also kind of ruminates, but I think the quatrains lend themselves to more of a sort of ballad feeling, right? Because the ballad structure is quatrains as well. And that sort of almost automatically creates a kind of timelessness that I think songs should have, poems can have.
Yeah, poems should have it, but they're...
Yeah.
They can be a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I would just realize, I mean, usually we don't go into formal poetry as much. I'm not versed as well as I should be in that because I've never been good at writing it.
Oh, it's so hard to write it and not make it contrived. And I think that's another reason that I sometimes choose it for songs, because it gives me some sort of something to kind of push against, or something to challenge. And I'm lucky in that all of the composers I work with want to write from the text. They want to be inspired by the text. So I have no constraints. So I think giving myself that constraint of form is really helpful in creating some kind of friction.
That I think that works. I had a friend try to... I tried to write something that he would set to music. And of course, it attempted to be formal, but it wasn't. It was like a free verse kind of... One of those free verse poems that's kind of... doesn't look like it's free verse. And not that it was bad or anything, it was decent for the, I mean, I wrote it back in college, but then he was like, okay, I'm gonna set that to music, but I'm gonna do something else with it. I never heard what happened to it. I don't think it got made. Which is fine. It's funny though, because I switched from writing poetry to fiction, which is I guess in a way that I guess that's a different form altogether than, but I utilize line breaks in my fiction.
Nice.
I've always been more attracted, I don't want to make it too much about me, but I would say one of there were two poets that I got turned on to when I went to college. One was by an accident because I happened to flip through a book of an anthology and I saw Frank Beidart's work.
Oh, yeah.
And Frank Beidart, I mean, he does, he uses the page a little bit like the way you do, although mm-hmm. he'll use it, he doesn't do this anymore, it seems like, but he used to write like 10 to 15 page mm-hmm. poems that are all over the page. And he would, apparently he would have problems, like he would have a writer's block because you couldn't figure out the right punctuation at the end of a line.
Yeah. It's hard.
Well, it was more, it seemed more important to him than most other poets.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so that kind of challenged me to not write, use the whole page and be mm-hmm. all over the place.
Well, it also goes to, you know, the fact that you can use line breaks are punctuation, right? So I really don't like to put commas at the ends of lines because there's a line break there. So a comma is like an extra break. So then it's kind of two stops.
Well, the thing that he did, mm-hmm. and it took him forever, he realized that he needed a dash and then a semicolon.
Oh,
or one
yeah.
or the other for yeah. some reason. At yep. the end. And that he like stopped writing that poem for like a week or longer or something.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But yeah, it's just weird like what can actually, it's, they're all different forms. And, you know, there seems to be there's a bias in terms of underground poets against formal verse at times when it is a useful, mm-hmm. at the very least, you should learn scansion.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, I mean, I think there have been great arguments made against the use of form by poets who were, you know, political poets like June Jordan and Adrian Rich have made great arguments about the sort of patriarchal pressure of form, and that they couldn't say the things that they needed to say within those forms.
Well, that makes sense. That's mm-hmm. that's I would argue that the patriarchal struggle is within the language itself, mm-hmm. that English yeah. is a very patriarchal yeah. language, as many other languages on the planet. And sorry, I'm thinking of something I need to do in my fiction.
Good.
But I would also argue that even, say, James Wright moved from writing formal poetry, which mm-hmm. was excellent, to writing free verse. Mm-hmm. And he was the other poet that really influenced me. And I heard about him from a professor who read his Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio, which is in The Branch Will Not Break, which is his break off, like where he went from one to the other. Mm-hmm. And he eventually did prose poetry too.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably all know this, but he was still writing in a form in that the poems were influenced by Chinese verse.
Yeah, right.
So this idea that you can get away from form altogether is not really true. They're all different forms. It's just what form are you using?
Right. Well, and I would say with both of these books, so they look very different on the page, and they sound very different when they're read, but they're both formal in that I sort of created a constraint and then stuck with it for the course of the book. So for example, like you were saying, the long lines in Why We Live in the Dark Ages give these the appearance of prose poems, and they feel like a prose poem, but I was really interested in actually exploring the arc of the sort of contemporary free verse poem that we might read in like The New Yorker or something.
So do you not consider them prose poetry?
I do not consider
okay,
them prose
sorry.
Poetry.
Okay, sorry for the assumption.
No, it's fine. Everyone assumes it. And I think that's pretty interesting, too, that occasionally, so some readers then will look at it and they'll realize, because as the book goes along, I start to break the lines so that it's a little bit clearer that they're long lines rather than prose.
They're not completely justified.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't catch on.
You know, well, and I got, so I was inspired actually by Carolyn Forshay's poem, The Colonel, which looks like a prose poem. It sort of reads like a prose poem, right? Because she's describing a scene. It's very narrative. And yet, if you look at it closely, you realize, oh, no, those are just long lines.
There are actual
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know how well I can actually articulate what's so fascinating to me about that, but there is something about that slippage between prose and poetry that I find a little bit maybe bewitching, just because it's kind of, it makes us realize, like, okay, well, why do we define prose this way? Why do we define poetry this way?
Yeah, it's all different. I mean, Louis Zukofsky, I think, butchering his name probably, said prose is poetry, and that it still tells you what, you know, it still tells you something on the page.
Right.
And using, I mean, I'm not the only writer to ever use line breaks in fiction. I mean, William Faulkner did, and as well as many others. So but yeah, I still didn't catch that.
Yeah.
So I feel bad.
Have you ever read Elfriede Jelinek's Women as Lovers?
No.
She wrote The Piano Teacher. That's what she's best known for. Austrian, won the Nobel a few years back. And Women as Lovers is written in sentences, but then there are, it's not exactly line breaks, it's, well, I guess so, in that the sentence will end and then the next sentence starts on the next line. So a little bit like Anne Carson's Autobiography of Red, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I always thought of as prose poetry, but you're correct, that's not.
Right. Yeah. So it's in this funny, it's,
although I'm thinking of The Beauty of the Husband, actually, but,
oh yeah, sure.
But that's still
the tangos.
It's kind of written in the same method, though, I think, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. These long lines that, are kind of exploring that funny, like the slippage between prose and poetry. I guess, I mean, there's a sense too of like, well, can we create something that's not prose or poetry? Like, why is it a binary?
That's always a good thing, to create a new form that someone else can pick up and try to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't happen very often. But fooling the reviewer and the reader into thinking it's prose is also a neat trick, too.
Yeah.
Do you want to read some more of either book, whichever one you want?
I'd be happy to. I'll read a couple more from Dark Ages, just to give a sense of the scope of the book. This is Missionaries. We did this for church. We let go all these balloons, well, one balloon each. With Bible verses on the cards, I think about friendship or loving one another. You know, children are always taught first, at least I was taught first, that verse, John 3:16. God loves the world. That means God loves you and you love your neighbor. Keep your hands to yourself. But I think that putting that on a balloon, it was supposed to be an introduction to evangelism or for a big ending to vacation Bible school week. I think one kid, I think her balloon went to China, maybe the Philippines. I had a beautiful plaid thermos, the classic plaid, for my milk, I think, and my teacher dropped it. It was glass. She was probably 15. I also had a peanut butter and jam sandwich and Doritos. We were outside in a row on an asphalt curb, and we were watching an eclipse of the sun, very carefully through a pinhole. I was so, so scared I would burn my eyes if I made one wrong move. And then at the end of the week, we let our balloons go, and I probably looked right at the sun when we were watching them float up anyway. Although that might have been a different year. So the book kind of, it starts with science and history and culture, and it arcs toward, by the end it becomes much more about language and theology, I guess. Sort of. So it goes from the physical to the metaphysical.
Metaphysical makes sense.
Yeah.
I didn't really get the theology, although it was in that poem, but I didn't notice that much of a strand of it. I did notice the men of science is, you're inverting the men of science very much.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of that?
I wasn't sure I thought it was, I felt that the book itself is very wry, so I thought it was made some musing and cutting remarks. I didn't really think that much about the fact that you're none of the men of science, other than possibly Alcibiades. Is that how you pronounce
Alcibiades?
It? Alcibiades. Is the only... No, he isn't technically a scientist either.
Tycho Brahe.
Tycho Brahe,
probably
that
like
is the
only
one
who's really a scientist.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I also didn't really think that much about the fact that you put Anne Sexton as a man of science, and that that's messing with the gender roles right there.
Yeah.
Right there, it's always man of science. You know, let's forget about Marie Curie and...
Right, yeah.
And, you know...
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's almost like Marie Curie sort of... she gets like the honorific of man.
Well, she becomes the exception that proves the rule, which
right.
is unfortunate. And well, I am pretty scientifically illiterate in the sense that I don't know who has been winning Nobel Prizes, but I think there is a definite gender bias there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. 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 I mean, girls aren't encouraged very often. I mean, I think that's changing, but historically girls haven't really been encouraged to play with lab sets or microscopes or otherwise
or
to sort of see themselves. Right, exactly.
Which is basically a language of science.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Who is it? The African-American astronomer who's famous.
Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Yes. I don't know if it was recent, but I remember reading something about... It was someone's poem about this, that he was playing with his astronomy set, with his telescope on a tenement on the roof, and a neighbor who didn't recognize him called the police on him because he thought it was a weapon.
Oh, jeez.
And that and one of the things he mentioned is that he wasn't really pushed towards becoming a scientist either.
Yeah, there's absolutely a racial bias as well.
Yeah.
For sure. And class, too.
And also feel that, and in a way, like the anti-intellectualism of the United States is also something. We want our kids to play football, which is much more dangerous than being a scientist.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting that anti-intellectualism, I think that, you know, with Why We Live in the Dark Ages, I think that, you know, another idea I hope comes up is that anti-intellectualism is, I think, also in part a response to this kind of gatekeeping that you're talking about, right? So if people feel as though they don't have access to this world of information, then it's kind of understandable that some of them would then say, well, I don't need it anyway.
Yeah.
You can have it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely true, too.
Yeah.
So I'm here in the studio. You're listening to Talking Earth. This is KBO Portland. I'm here in the studio with Megan Levad, poet with two fairly recent books, one which has not even come out, called What Have I to Say to You?
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, and I can't remember the name, it's Why We Live in the Dark Ages, which we've been talking about for a little while.
Yeah.
Did you want to read something out of your new book? Or
I'd be delighted to. Reader, my heart is broken, which means it doesn't work anymore, even if it's wound every night. The Rust Belt turns to me at the strip mall sports bar, says, "Am I going to die?" I tell him to finish his turkey burger and motion to the waitress, young and lovely, tits on a stick, for the check. If I manage my affairs correctly, it will be like I was never here.
Yikes.
I know, they tend to go dark pretty quick. Reader, I have of late come into a dictatorship. The country is perhaps only 8x10, but rich with building materials, strange birds, and ornamental grasses. I have found myself to possess a natural talent for the work. The agricultural industrial complex turns to me at the karaoke bar, says, "The man loved making commitments." I picture a heart overflowing with tight scrolls, appointments scribbled on each one. God damn it, somebody already did Jolene. Light pencil, fine hand. Reader, this year's spiders have more horrible faces and day jobs. I can only afford to keep them down here for an hour a night. Please think of that hour as a signifier for the whole night. Reader, my nation is an autonomy, but I promise there's room enough for two. Just do as I say, and do as you say too. I love you more than God loves you. And like God, I love myself still more. All existence contingent upon my existence. I am prepared. High quality inflatable mattress, peppermint castile soap, hand crank flashlight / radio, gallons and gallons of water. I have filled the first aid kit with bandages and salves. Come, radiant bridegroom, all is ready. I don't care if we have to go back so far that our skulls thicken, grow slope-browed and narrow, heavy. I want to get to the bottom of it. Reader, when this is all over, I think we should go have our hymen surgically reconstructed. Or we could get coney dogs. I just want to spend the day with you. I never lied. Any expectations are your own responsibility. But I am a generous boss, so whatever you mistook may be returned to the locker under the stairs. I wrote the combination on the waterline of your left eyelid as you slept. You know, we're friends now, so we should split the check. Reader, only when free from projections can we be aware of reality. You are sensitive, sympathetic, and considerate. You have a strong desire for home and family. Your next interview will result in a job. After the last skein of geese bossed through overhead, I went inside. Now the circle we've drawn around us sounds like space, which is to say, the polite clink of blood cells queuing in quiet chains. Marketable nostalgia turns to me at the private library, says, "Suicides never consider, who am I doing this to? My first thought is, to whom am I doing this?" And then I realize my reconstruction makes the suicide an actor, self-murderer. He touches a hard gilt spine with one finger. My sorrow is chthonic. A choir of lowing wails could not move the stone I've set upon it. When a compass is broken, it can be replaced. Needle, cork, shallow dish is all it takes. More difficult is learning the compass is broken. That part takes decades of wandering in the desert. Reader, remember, all of this takes place in bed. Because you work so hard, I punish myself. Make the day a tight plate. Garden, market, stiff rows of clean dishes. Office, jogging, inbox zero. I tick off the seconds under my breath. Wait for you to find me worthy. Complete, incorruptible, sound throughout. Neoliberalism turns to me at the apothecary, says, "He was my Starbuck." She is color matched to radiant, while I dimple the rubber dropper tops with my forefinger. If we could stay, I would time them, see which ones pop first, but I still wouldn't know why. He could comply, but he could never agree.
That is Starbuck.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, he could comply, but he could never agree.
He didn't disagree very much, though.
Well,
I can't remember.
Oh yeah, Starbuck? No, he thought this was,
I need to read
thought
Moby
it was
Dick
a terrible
again.
Idea. So my favorite part of Moby Dick is his soliloquy, which it's iambic, and so my soul is more than matched. She's overmanned, and by a madman, no less. It's this really beautiful moment.
Is that near the end?
It's actually near the beginning. It's
near the
before
beginning.
They even nail the gold doubloon to this to this mast. Yeah. It's very early on, and he's like, "What are we doing? This is a terrible idea."
Yeah.
Yeah.
It took me a year to finish that.
Oh.
It took me less time to read Ulysses than.
Well, there is a way in which Ulysses you can just kind of let it wash. Right.
And that's pretty
if
much
you didn't
did.
Catch something, you're like, "Oh well, I didn't catch that." Moby Dick doesn't quite feel that way.
it's more episodic too.
Yeah.
Farther reaching in that there's, you know, it's not just one day.
Right. Absolutely.
But I think it was also, I had the good fortune to have bad fortune to be working as a security guard who didn't have to do anything. So I just read.
Nice. That sounds amazing.
I did that for a little while and then I didn't do that again.
Yeah.
But I wrote a lot and I didn't write fiction though while I was doing that, which, oh well.
So now you regret it because you're like, I had so much time to write fiction because fiction takes a long time.
I don't know. I mean, youth is wasted on the young. Right. I wrote poetry.
Yeah.
It's not like I was going to make money either way, so.
Well, no, exactly.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But, we've been here in the studio with Megan Levad. You're listening to Talking Earth. This is KBO Portland. You are reading tonight, which, granted, is in the far past at this moment when you dear readers are hearing it. So you either made it to Megan Levad's reading at
the Cardinal Club
tonight, which is the October
28th. Saturday, October 28th, and the event's at 5 to 7.
It was at 5.
Yes.
Now it's January. You don't have any other plans to come back to the Portland area anytime soon?
Well, my publisher, Tavern Books, is here in Portland, so I will always, you know, come back to Portland for events. And I live in San Francisco, so it's not so far. And I'll certainly be back in a year for the Associated Writers and Writing Programs Conference, which will be in Portland in 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then perhaps we should talk about your publisher just a little
bit.
What is the... I'm going to mispronounce it.
Rolstad series?
Yes. Did you want to talk just a little bit about that?
Gladly, yeah. So the Rolstad series was started in honor of Greta Rolstad, a poet who died unexpectedly and young. And it was started in part in response to the sort of lack of publishing opportunities for women.
Yeah.
So, you know, as much as it seems, and I think that poetry actually does pretty well in terms of gender parity, but as much as it seems that women publish as much as men, the numbers just don't show that.
No, I think women write more than men, actually, and they publish less.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So VITA, the Women in Literary Arts Organization, has become known for doing a count, right, where they just look at the numbers, how many women have published in all of these different literary magazines or, you know, have published their books through different presses. And I love that when those numbers came out a few years ago, Tavern's response was, hey, let's create a publishing opportunity for emerging women poets.
And Tavern Publisher, it's in Portland.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember. I didn't do my research, I have to say that.
Well, Tavern was originally founded, by Carl Adamczyk and Michael McGriff. And,
okay, that sounds familiar now.
Yeah, yeah, and Mike's no longer with Tavern. It's run by Carl and Natalie Garriott, and they're brilliant editors and I have been really happy to work with them. They're such good readers, so smart. And so Tavern was initially started, though, to publish books in translation and books that were out of print. So really a very much kind of almost an archival sort of project, really trying to, they call it the Living Library, but really trying to get on paper some of these works that would otherwise be lost or, you know, we just
wouldn't. Fall through the cracks.
Yeah, or fall through the cracks or that we wouldn't have access to in English. So I think, I mean, that's another thing that they do that's pretty amazing is all the translation that they do. That's huge. There's so little. I think the last time I heard a statistic, I would hope it's higher now, but something like 2% of the books published in the U.S. every year are translations.
That sounds about right, actually. I mean, I have to say I barely know German.
Like, yeah.
Sehr schlecht.
Well, and so the danger of it is that, and this is not surprising at all, it just makes us even more myopic.
And anti-intellectual.
Right,
yeah. is a lot of actual, a lot of important works in science and literature written in Latin or German,
mm-hmm.
Especially in science. And then mm-hmm. also just, you know,
yeah.
literature is written in any language on the planet.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about the fact that literature is one of the best ways for us to understand the subjective experience of an objective reality or decision that's made, you know, how does it feel to live under, you know, how a particular regime, right? Or how does it feel to deal with the effects of the changes in technology and our access to it? Literature is great for sharing that. And if we are only reading literature in English, then we're missing out on the subjective experiences of most of the world.
Yes.
And it makes it a lot easier to not even consider them, to not even think about others' experiences. Yeah.
Yes, it does. And it well, yeah. You have been listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Picard. I've been in here in the studio with Megan Levad. Do you have another poem you want to share to end with?
I would love to.
And while you're picking it out, I just want to say thanks to Natalie
Garriott,
for helping to set this up as well.
Yeah.
At Tavern Books.
I would like to, if you don't mind, I'll end with a couple from the new book, What Have I to Say to You, which just came out in fall of 2017. And then I'll close with the final book from Why We Live in the Dark Ages. We would have grown bored, this no man's land for two, the every day of it. Eventually, we would have had to release our balloons, a prayer that somebody else is out there. Wait, listen. Reader, when I wake from all this, in the cave of your curved body, my wristwatch on the nightstand, please know I meant everything I said. I stomped your name into the dirt, letters taller than wooden gods invisible from Mars. You're never getting out of here. Love turns to me at the oxygen bar, says, I'm going to miss my flight. Our toxins are being replaced with lavender and chamomile. I hope he parks, not circles. Either way, I'm traveling alone. And the final poem from Why We Live in the Dark Ages is one of those great men of science poems. But it's great men of science Coco, as in the famous gorilla who learned sign. Feet is her word for men, and lip is her word for woman. Remember the book Coco and Her Kitten? All Ball, that was the kitten's name. Maybe because he didn't have a tail, he was all ball. So when she was captured as a baby, her story of it about that is, feet come, feet, feet, no, mother, 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 mother. So sad. She has a lot of words and makes things up, too. If someone makes her mad, she calls them toilet devil. Also, she had a boyfriend. I think his name was Mike, but Mike didn't take to signing to language very well. He just liked to say meat. Or he wouldn't have been saying it, you know what I mean. When they, the researchers who live with them, with the gorillas, I think they live in a house too, like people. When they asked him to use it in a sentence, he signed, meat, 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 meat. Which you can actually do with, oh, what is the word? With buffalo. Buffalo, 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 buffalo. As in Buffalo the animals from Buffalo, New York, fool other buffaloes from Buffalo. I don't know why you would ever write that except to do it. But I don't think there are any other words that work that way, so that's probably a good enough reason. So the hope was that Coco and Mike would have a baby, but I don't know if they ever did, or if they did, it took a long time. She didn't like him much because he was a dunce. She liked people and All Ball. But All Ball got hit by a car. Coco cried, and then she signed, sleep, cat.
That's really sad.
Thanks.
thanks for coming on the show, Megan.
Thanks, Patrick.
We've been listening to Megan Levad. This is Talking Earth. You're listening to KBO Portland. Please stay tuned for the next show. Thank you.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.